Welcome to the DoorDig Studios, Creative Women in Conversation. The DoorDig Studio is a not-for-profit house museum with a gallery and sculpture garden. It is the former home of Slava Horovitz-Doldig and her husband, sculptor Carl Doldig. The DoorDig Studio holds a nationally significant collection of sculptures, artworks, furniture and archives, which tell the story of this emigre family's journey from Europe via Switzerland and Singapore to Australia. The DoorDig Studio aims to inspire creative journeys through the telling of this story and through its public and education programs. This series of talks is inspired by Slava's inventiveness and interests. Our two creative women in conversation will explore influences, ideas and stories in the creative process. Welcome to Creative Women in Conversation number 4. This week we're talking about furniture design. Our speakers are Grazia Materia and Jane Scott. Grazia Materia has made it her mission to introduce mid-century modernist furniture design classics to interior designers and the interested public. Grazia's company, Grazia & Co., were recently partnered in the launch of Featherston 2016, a collaboration by Gordon Mather, Mary Featherston and Grazia & Co. that showcases several Featherston classics, revitalised in contemporary fabrics and colours. Grazia's Australian-made furniture pieces are elegant and scrupulously crafted. Jane Scott, art consultant, is well qualified to talk about furniture design. Through her former role as CEO of Craft Victoria, Jane has worked with a diverse range of artisans and craftspeople over the years. She is a great advocate for craft, design and the handmade. Previous positions have included Director, Tarawarra Museum of Art, Director, the Monash Gallery of Art, and Executive Director of Regional Arts Australia. She is also Cultural Attaché to the Embassy of Australia, Washington, D.C. Welcome, Grazia and Jane.
Thank you very much. I'd just also like to start this afternoon by acknowledging the traditional owners on the land on which we are going to have this ripping discussion today, and to the elders past and present. So thanks. And also I wanted to just quickly introduce the chairs. This is so comfortable. This is Eva's kitchen.
No, what you're sitting on.
What I'm sitting on, yes, is Eva's kitchen stool. Thank you. But it's not nearly as comfortable as this delightful chair down here. So I'm going the oboe, which is back here, and we're going to talk in more details about these chairs, but it was fantastic that Grazia brought them in at, great tussle in the car, I'm sure. We've also got the R160.
Correct.
Yes. And we've also got the relaxation chair, which is this one over here. So welcome to the chairs. And if I slide off into one of these chairs, don't be at all surprised because they are incredibly comfortable. So we're going to start off, I think Grazia and I have been sort of talking through the week and figuring out what we want to get to kind of as quickly as we possibly can, the good stuff, and not waffle on too much about the less interesting. So we're going to try and stay on point with that. And so we're just going to launch straight into Grazia, and I hope you've all had a chance to jump online and have a look at Grazia & Co.'s website, which is fantastic and full of amazing furniture. Congratulations. Grazia clearly is a very young woman and has had incredible success in developing up her own company. And the thing that I wanted to know was the three key things that have allowed you to have this great successful company at such an early age.
I think the things that you fail at pretty much tell you that you shouldn't continue in that direction. So I think the first step for me was getting into interior design at RMIT and realising that you are the worst in the class. and I'm not just saying that to be funny, I genuinely was, and I probably repeated many classes that I'm sure, in particular one, I was given a pass so I didn't have to repeat it for the fourth time. So that kind of led me on to, well, why did I start this course? I loved it because of the interiors, but I'm not good at it. I didn't want to draw up kitchens and bathrooms. And then I always loved furniture and the history of furniture and the making of it as well, but never really researched it so much. But I continued down the path of interior design, and I ended up working for a lady who had previously worked at Inark, which was a very good firm at the time, and she'd gone out on her own, and her name was Catherine Lombard. She happened to be married to Gordon May, the industry, so I'd started working from there, and they had a shared office, and it was just how, mm-hmm. you know, circumstances just were there. And so I was working for her, but I really wanted to work for him. So I realised that, and I think she also was fine that I went and worked for him, because I wasn't as good as she thought I was going to be as well. But so I think you acknowledge what you can't do and then follow what you like, and that was probably the first step. How I got into furniture, is that the question, or have I?
Yeah, yeah, no, yeah. So I've got study,
yes.
Find a mentor.
Definitely find a mentor, and Gordon would definitely have been my mentor in furniture.
Yep. And the third?
The third, well, today I probably look at things differently. Having had 10 years working with Gordon and Mary, then starting another business that went for 10 years but ended badly, I knew that the next one that I started, you kind of go, well, that's exactly what I'm not going to do. This is what I am going to do. So you have a clearer and you're a bit more steadfast in those decisions that you make. And I know one of the key things was quality. So, you know, so you just kind of, you just learn as you go, really. There's no
It's wising up.
Yeah.
See your mistakes and
yeah. Absolutely. And aligning yourself with people that teach you and inspire you, you know, that's another thing that I've really, I think that's a big reason why the business has been successful. I'm working with designers and architects who their work inspires.
Mm-hmm.
And I still work with Gordon and Mary Featherston. So,
yeah. That kind of brings us to, I mean, the wonderful relationship that you have with the Featherstons.
Mm-hmm.
And Featherston's furniture, of course, everybody knows wonderful kind of iconic furniture from the 50s and 60s. Most of us aspire to have some, if not lucky enough to have some. But your relationship with the Featherstons, I mean, how did that come about, and how did you work with them to be able to reproduce their fantastic designs?
I had met Mary when I worked for Gordon, so that was in the 90s, pretty much. Gordon started, had the license from 1989, and I came on board in 1993 or something. So, and I worked pretty much alongside Gordon, and Gordon was kind of the direct contact to Mary. Grant sadly died in 1995, so there was only a small window where Gordon actually had contact, and Mary pretty much took over from then.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the opportunity of meeting her, but certainly in the background at that point. And then going separate ways and having started this business, there was a job at the Art Centre, where an architect friend of mine was at. We were at home and she was sitting on Featherston scape chairs, and she said, God, these are comfortable. These would be great for that job. I'm going, I know, they would. So I rang Gordon the next day, not the next day, but shortly afterwards, and I said, what would it take to get these back in production? He's like, oh, God, too much, you know. But I said, what if there were 100 of them? And he goes, oh, I'll look into it then, you know. So that was how it started. And then when we did that job and they turned out so beautifully, he said, why don't you take it over? Because at that point he was not looking at retiring, but the energy levels after, you know, doing it from 89, you know, he didn't necessarily need to work as hard as he had been. And I said, well, I won't take it over, because there is so much. I know what, after 10 years of working for him, you learn how much he's involved in making them. And we had just started Grazia & Co. and I had my plate was full with that production, let alone taking on a brand like Featherston. So I said, what if we share it, we'll join forces, I'll market it, sell it, I'll pick what we do, you know, we'll just be as a three. So he approached Mary. Mary was on board, and that's how we did the Featherston relaunch in 16 last year.
So with the copyright issue around reproducing the chairs,
the Featherston Family Trust still have full rights to the product. Unfortunately, they weren't registered designs, so the products, we went through the archives, we asked Mary with her permission, and we selected, or Gordon and I selected, what product we thought we would relaunch that would could be reworked to fit today's market, you know. And it was about changing the fabrics, changing the finishes, changing some of, no proportions were changed, just they're all made to the original specs, and they're still all, other than this one, all made by hand, really. So so we re-registered them. That helps us in Australia. It doesn't help us so much overseas in with Australian law, unfortunately. But had the laws in Australia been like they are in the EU and the UK, these designs would still be protected today. But we don't have those laws here, unfortunately. In fact, we're the, one of the few countries that still has it legally okay to bring in a replica furniture into this country. So unfortunately, Australia's become the dumping ground of replica. And we don't even have a, you can actually still, as long as you have the word replica in front of it, you can actually still use replica Grant Featherstone contour chair. I mean, it is, you're even using the person's name. Like, it's just appalling. But hopefully with a few things, it's a very slow mover with this issue, but we're doing our best we can in regards to protecting them, at least in this country. We don't, we get a lot of inquiries from overseas, and we're very selective about who we sell to overseas for obvious reasons.
The awareness about buying quality rather than quantity, which, and we've had some chats about, you know, how appalled we are with the sort of the blockhead design mentality that we've got in Australia with all of these home renovation shows where it's like you just either knock up some stuff yourself or you purchase cheap and nasty stuff, and or it doesn't matter because, quite frankly, you're going to change your design. Next season you want a whole new colour palette, and, you know, these designers that there's absolutely no integrity in choosing something that you're going to live with as a meaningful object that's going to be with you, and you might pass it on to your children or grandchildren as a beautiful piece of furniture. And that's one of the great tragedies, which is why your work with Featherstone and making sure that this is a unique product is so fantastic.
Well, thanks, Jane. I think no different to what Eva's done with this property. If something's well made and it's good, there's no reason to dispose of it. And I think that's the fundamental thing that sadly we're missed a little bit here, you know. And it is things like the blockheads, and I blame Aldi too. When you can buy a ghost chair, a Philips Dark Design ghost chair for $30 in Aldi, it's like, well, there's something wrong. It's just mind-boggling. I mean, you can buy a replica R160. They're as common as a McDonald's. You know, like they're everywhere. And it's sad, really. It's tragic because it does not represent the value of what IP and design is, you know, and I think that's the biggest tragedy. And it's only a few countries, and we're one of them, that doesn't get it. I mean, the Danes get it. They get it in Europe. I mean, they get it in the UK. I mean, what are we doing wrong? You know, so, but it's a very slow process, and it's... you know, it's affected our business on many occasions, but, you know, you can go down the path of legal, but then it's about, have you got the headspace, the money to put into it when you're trying to focus on positive things? Do you need to be bogged down? I mean, at the start you're fired up and you're like, rrr. But it really, you just have to let it go at this point.
So what do? You know, you see, and my time at Craft Victoria too, so many of the makers and designers were producing work, and then they'd see it in a Target catalogue. And there's very little recourse. I mean, how do you stay on top of that? I mean, I spent time with some artists who just got so depressed. They were sort of at the point of, I just don't know why I bother making anymore because it's just going to get ripped off by one of these big companies and no one seems to care. You know, how do you stay on top of that kind of thing?
Well, it's funny you mentioned Target because there was this, I can't remember the designer's name now, but you might know, one of her prints was ripped off, and she took it legally and she won. So it was one of the very few that have gone. And about
it was a painter, John Campbell, wasn't it? I was just looking around the room if anybody knows. I think It was John Campbell. There was, yeah, he had some work that was also ripped off. And they,
okay.
Yeah, same story though.
Okay, same story. So the barrister that represented this girl, she was a girl, definitely a lady, she bought a Featherston. And I was, you know, I don't always see everyone that walks in, but on this particular day, I saw her and I explained that, you know, you get a certificate of authenticity signed by Mary when you purchase one, you know, so you know it's the real thing. She said, I know all about it. I'm a IP barrister. And I went, oh, God, thank God, you know. So then I started doing it. And guess who ripped us off? And I was doing I gave her the whole story. And she's like, oh, you should take that one up, you know. So, of course, as soon as she's left the building, I'm straight upstairs talking to my husband. We have got a chance to beat them, you know. And, of course, we could have gone down that path, but I had to let it go, Jane, because at the end of the day, the very people that copied us, which I'm very happy to say was Freedom Furniture, they are the very people that can afford to pay someone the right money to design something original. Mm-hmm. And for them to rip a small business of six employees off, they've clearly, it's like an absolute replica of our bar unit. I was emotional about it, I was angry about it, and then you get to the point where it's like, well, you know what, you can keep copying, you can't come up with the ideas, and that's the only leverage that you've got. It's like, okay, you can have it, I'll come up with something else, you know, because there was no, you couldn't fight that one. Mm. I mean, you could have, but they're set up so strategically in those companies that they have everything ticked off, you know. Mm. So, but one day when I have the money and the headspace, I'll take one on, don't worry.
I think it's kind of up to all of us to ask that question when you're purchasing. Who's the designer? Who designed this? And if, quite frankly, if they can't answer the question, you know they've just ripped it off somebody and they're not actually paying a designer. So it's kind of an education, really. As consumers, we have to actually ask those questions.
Yeah,
true. You know, it's good. Yes, it's flattering. You know, the old financial, the artist is always the last person to
get
paid. But, you know, imagine if it was a painter and somebody just started knocking out paintings. I mean, we all know what Brett Whiteley, you know, I mean, there's we wouldn't stand for it. But when it comes to design, for some reason we're a little bit more, not so much. Anyway, one of the things I love about your company and what you're doing is really working on the authenticity and community aspect to your work. Do you want to talk a bit about the crew that you've got in there?
Yeah, so we work with four designers. Mm-hmm. Some of them interior designers gone into furniture design like myself. We do a lot of collaborative work. So because we've got the manufacturing side, you'll often get designers that will say, well, we've got this project and we want to make this. Can you do it? And you can always do it. You can always make what they ask, and sometimes you think, oh, it's horrid, but I'll make it anyway. And then there's other ones that you go, this is actually beautiful. Would you be interested in adding it to our range under your brand? And we've done that with a couple of, we've done it with Russell and George, who've designed out that beautiful millipede sofa, which has now just been installed into 101 Collins Street. Mm. We manufactured that. And then Claire Cousins Architects have done a beautiful coffee table called the Ivy Coffee Table. It's very simple. And the mechanics of that are very easy to adjust. So you've got these beautiful cylindrical legs with a thread on the top, and you can apply that to a timber top or a glass top or a marble top. So, you know, you've got the diversity. So it's commercially viable because you can offer it in different sizes. You can see where it goes from a business point of view, not just from a design point of view.
Right. So and you have the option of changing it next season should you wish to.
Yes, but majority of people that we deal with don't do that. Yes. They're shopping at Freedom, Jane.
Yes, that's right. Terrible. Sorry, I broke your chain of thought. One of the things I did want to talk about too was with the work that you've done with particularly the oboe chair, that when that was initially first designed, the materials that were involved in that and what you've had to do to kind of make it viable again.
Yeah, so the foam that was used then was made by Pacific Dunlop, and it was an injected foam. Still made the same way. It's made in two spheres that get glued together, and inside there's like polystyrene balls like in a bean bag. And the one that Mary has and the one that's in the NGV is completely, it's like really bouncy and really light. And when we went to remake them, which is another story, so do I tell that story?
Yeah.
So when we were picking all the product that we were going to make, we were at Mary's house and we were showing her the prototypes of the B230, which is the bigger chair with the wings on the side. And just as we were leaving, and I said, Mary, what's your favourite piece? She goes, I would love to see the oboe. And ironically, when I worked for Gordon for 10 years, I kept saying, can we make the oboe? Can we make the oboe? And he's like, no, it never sell. We'll never sell. We're not doing the oboe. But then when Mary said, I like the oboe, Gordon just went, oh, no. And I'm going, we are so doing that oboe. So it was... This has been probably the most problematic, and it's the simplest form, yet the most difficult and the most costly process to make. So the foam that they use then is carcinogenic. So it's almost like the asbestos of foam. So we don't bring it in anymore. And then the other issue that we've had, sadly, is that we had a beautiful foam formula because it was done with a formula. But now that the car industry has gone in the country, that there's one chemical that you need to make it set or something that we can't any longer get. So we've now had to reformulate it a third time, which is very costly. We've still got the mould, which is two spheres that are joined together. But, yeah, so that's a new formula. If you have Mary's original ball and this ball, this is much denser. But it's quite tricky to get a formula that you can sit on, and then the complete ball, you know, returned back to a sphere. So we've had a few little issues with it, you know, the beans popping out of the holes and things like that. But we're getting there. We've had to buy a new glue machine and, you know, my little boy was standing on the back of our sofa and decided that he would be airborne and jump on it, so the whole thing exploded. So we didn't realise that there'll be other children doing that, so we had to change again how we're going to do it.
It's called product testing.
But it was horrendous. The beans went everywhere. I was... like, oh, God, what am I going to do? There'll be other kids that will do the same thing.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, we've had to change the seal on it, and now we use a medical bandage that goes over the edge to seal it over. You know, so there's things that are in development that were never needed to be done back when Mary and Grant were making that chair, that we have to implement it now.
Yeah. So there's, you know, a lot of kind of research that goes on with the development of all of these products, even when you're kind of doing a reissue of an old one. You know, it never stops the kind of creative process in trying to figure out what's going to be best for today's environment, which is fantastic. And I was reminded of a story where a fashion designer was asked what was the most important thing that had happened in the fashion industry, and he, as quick as a flash, said the development of Lycra changed everything. And so, you know, I asked Grazia the same question, like, what is the thing that has really changed furniture?
Well, Lycra would have been the 70s.
Yep.
And see, injected foam was also the 70s. So, you know, this is an injected foam, but, you know, you go back to, like, Gio Ponti's big mama chair, and that is one of my favourite chairs of all time. It's ridiculous, but it's amazing. And it was the time where all that experimental, chemical reactions with foam were all happening. So I would say in upholstery, I'd say it would be foam, really.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I'm conscious of the time. We're starting to get to that point. But in terms of following through your ideas, the process, can you talk a little bit about, you know, from woe to go, you know, what are the kind of key elements with your process?
In designing and then into manufacture?
That's right,
It depends on the product, obviously, but you don't sit at your desk and start, I'm going to design a chair today. It doesn't kind of work like that. But you often, you know, if a designer or an architect's come to you to design something or work on a design that they've come up with, you then work out, okay, is it going to be, let's use the Ivy coffee table, you know, is it going to, how are you going to construct it, or the sun lounger that we've just developed, you know, all the elements that go into that. You have to roll the metal, you know, if it's outdoor, we want it to be stainless steel because I don't want the problems if we do mild steel and it rusts, so then you need to know your grades of your stainless steel. So all that process is you're dealing very much on the factory floor and asking all those questions really early on. It's a long process.
But I would say that's a sign of a successful designer and artist and architect, but somebody that's actually getting out into the materials and yep. really understanding how your materials work in order to kind of appropriately place them with the right design.
Yeah, and I'm sure Flava would have had a similar issue with, she would have been dealing with manufacturers daily to get that. She would have come up with the concept and the ideas of how it would work. But at some point in time, you have to take it past the drawing. You know, you have to take it to, okay, what are the actual mechanics of this?
Yeah, and also feeling what is it that I actually need at any given time in my life, and then extrapolating that into the practical world. And, you know, one of the things that I've got in my handbag here today, because it may well rain, and, of course, that was Slava's invention, which is back here in the case, was the compact umbrella. And, you know, how fantastic. I mean, that's just thinking about, I really need to have an umbrella and put in my handbag. Who's going to design it? A woman, of course, who needs to put an umbrella. Yeah. You know, and at the time, so it's that sort of practical application.
Yeah. So I'd say there are thought processes that are different. I mean, I know when we did our little Leo bedside table, my biggest pet hate was you put a lamp on the bedside table and you'd see the cord hanging down. So we put on our Leo bedside, we put a solid back on it, and everyone was like, oh, that's fantastic. You don't see any of the cords, you know. So now we've started doing things like you've got a little USB thing attached as well. So it's kind of how you progress with what is, you know, the demands of what people want, really. So, yeah, I guess that's...
Yep. Yeah, fantastic. So what advice would you offer to women in particular who are embarking in a career in art and design? What advice?
Patience and persistence, really. Yeah. But you have to love it and you have to be committed to it. And you don't go in it to make any money. You do it because you love it, I think. And then, not to say you can't, but I think people can tell when you're passionate about something. And I think one thing I've still to this day is you keep on learning as you go, you know. And I probably learn, you know, from the Featherstone point of view, I would have learnt more from Mary and Gordon. The knowledge that they've shared, you know, has helped me develop other avenues in our own range. So, you know, whether it be timbers that don't yellow. I mean, Gordon specifically uses an American white oak, and I used to use American oak, you know, and I thought, well, why is that? Because it doesn't yellow so much. I remember that one, you know. So there's all these little things that you don't even know, but as you go, you learn things. So I think you just align yourself with people that you respect and do similar things, because you'll be surprised how much you learn from them, and I think you'll just develop your own style.
Yep. So make sure you've got a positive posse around you.
Yeah, definitely positive.
Yeah.
Well, you'll get negative too, but
yeah, well, you have to take that. Of course, but yes. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane, for helping you out.
That was brilliant. Now, I'm sort of keeping us on track. That's sort of our 35 minutes, but I understand we can take some questions and open the discussion up to the rest of the room. So, here we go. Yes.
I would like to know, apart from perhaps the changes in materials due to safety and hazard issues, what has changed between, what's changed from manufacturing furniture in the Featherstone era and how we manufacture furniture now? What is different? I know you say some of these things are almost handmade, but what's the difference in getting something actually out onto the shop floor?
The Contour series, anything from the Featherstone range that has got the ply shell, they used to be all still layered with ply, and back then they were all glued. Again, with permission from the Featherstone Family Trust, we now screw them as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the base is different because originally they were just literally four screws put in. Now we've got a T-nut that actually fixes on because they're much stronger to the base. So behind the scenes there's things that have changed because we've got different, you know, we've got an electric drill now. Well, you had one then too, but it was a different process of the T-nut. So those things have changed, tweaking it just to make it an easier, more manageable and durability-wise. You know, you'd know when you're reupholstering all the vintage ones, they're all twisting, and that's because there was a different glue. Back then they went very brittle. It's a different glue. So those things have changed. In regards to the process of just making generic furniture pieces. I mean, now it's all done on computer. You generate a drawing on CAD, it's all dimensions. That same drawing goes to a machine, a CNC machine, it cuts it out, and you know, there's still a production line involved. But that doesn't apply to pieces like the relaxation chair. I mean, I specifically brought this one because I thought there was a really nice relationship between the chairs that Slava had and selected because of the webbing. But this is all still done by hand, these ones.
So is that designed by hand in terms of, like, you...
That would have been hand drawing. Yeah. Definitely a hand drawing, yep. Yeah. And they're all in the Featherstone archives, you know, getting that curve right, you know. Yeah. So, yeah.
It's quite beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's actually low, but it's very comfortable, so you're welcome to try it.
Who would be in Australia today, furniture-wise, who is the new Grant Featherstone? Because I love mid-century modern.
Yes.
I'm a product of that era as well. I'm an authentic mid-century modern piece.
Yes.
And, you know, I love having one or two authentic items because I've loved them forever. My parents had Fleur chairs and their dining table and their chairs. I still have. I'm an early child. They had three chairs and I always wanted a sofa or a lounge, but we always just had three chairs, one for mum, dad and myself. But furniture today, I wonder where it... What is our flavour? I mean, who do we... Who are we in Australia? And I'm very confused because I'd love to have an authentic, I mean, Australian beautiful piece that would become perhaps iconic. Mark Newson,
Mark Newson. Yeah. I was just about to say, I mean, he, like Featherstone, you know, he did different types, you know, his sculpture, he's done industrial design, he's worked with plastics, you know, he's done, you know, the dish rack range, and but he's done furniture and then he's gone on to do, you know, the seating in Qantas. Yeah, so he would probably be the closest, I'd say, to Grant today. You know, he doesn't live here anymore.
But he do have lots of terrific furniture designers.
Yeah. I mean, Adam Goodrum is, you know, definitely one that's everyone talking about. But I think globalisation and, you know, the internet makes everything blurred, you know, more so now. Everything's so quick and trends are a bit, you know... That's why I think people cling to... There's nostalgia in Featherstone, but you're still buying the quality and, you know, people tried to replicate it thinking that that's the trend, but it's actually not a trend. It's something like what Eva's done. It's something you do hand down to the next generation. They're made that way, you know. They're made by hand and, you know... People that buy them with the intent. People go in and have three children and will buy three pieces because they've got the intention of handing it down. So that's your client. That's who we want to deal with, you know, like you've kept yours, you know, because otherwise it's just everything's disposable, you know. It all ends up in cheap landfill, you know, so...
I mean, the conversation seems to be, am I going to do Tuscan? Are we Tuscan or are we French provincial?
Yes.
Or
shabby chic.
Yes.
If I hear that one more time.
Or, you know, the cane's coming in now, all this cane.
I know. And I just love that you've just given me an idea for another show, which is called Beyond Trend.
Oh, yep.
But there's also the NGV, of course, opens next week, their big art and design extravaganza, which... There's over 100 designer, artists, makers. Good time to go in and have a look if you're actually having a two-way bet on who's the bee's knees in the future. That might be one of those shows that you could do some research. And of course, you know, here we have one. You know what Grazia and Co are doing is fantastic. I mean, there's the Featherstone line, but there's also their own design line, which is innovative and really Australian and very exciting. So, you know, you might look back on this day and go, "I met her! Yes. Oh my God!
You better stop now."
So, you know, but my other thing too is if you find a designer that you love their work, support them. You know, make the commission, make the kind of lifetime investment. Don't kind of, you know, let the bank balance kind of sway you over to IKEA again and get a crappy thing that you're going to throw out in 12 months. You know, if you work out how many times you throw out that cheap, nasty, designed whatever,
over your lifetime, you would have been much better off just paying up front, getting something decent, and you end up with something that's actually worth something. Anyway, I'll shut up about that. I can't push that out. Did we have any more questions?
How far away are we from 3D printing for making furniture?
Oh, really? We're not in that league, as in our business isn't. But I know that in Europe they have started that 3D modelling concept, but they're like miniature versions. Is that what you mean, or just to get the proportions?
Yeah, for instance, if you took the chair,
yes,
with its sort of curved shapes, and as I understand, a plywood base.
Yes.
Now, if you could actually make that out of strong plastic with 3D printing, it's got to be simpler and easier to make.
Yes. Part of the licensing agreement with Mary and the family is that they are made exactly the same way. And the replicas, they're a plastic mold essentially. They're cheaper. They don't feel the same. They're not what Mary would call an authentic version of that chair. So I don't think it would apply to. Sure, if it makes our life easier from our range, which is not doesn't have that iconic.
But they're also the 3D printers now, not necessarily in plastics too.
All sorts of materials.
Yeah, so there's ceramic pots now all that are, sculptures that you see. So I think we're on the
cusp
of that technology really booming, and depending on
cars, I know they do it with cars.
Yeah,
but I think you need to have firstly the population and the volume to be able to justify the cost because. And the budget. Well, we're not in that league. I would imagine possibly in Australia, someone like Stylecraft might be probably the only Australian company, even though they've got other international brands, that would be in that league, really, that I know of. But we haven't looked into it. Who knows? It might be
the art of the handmade, I think, is something that, we really have to hold on to too because, there are... Lord knows there's so much kind of mass-produced objects. It's great to know that some people are still valuing the business of hand-making things.
Hi. If I could just add a little bit to that. I'm a guide in the triennial. And a lot of the things that are coming out and discussing the designers and so on is that, yes, it might be computer-generated and so on, but it's hand-finished and the combination and...
Yep.
Supposedly the rise of the artisan again to hand finish these things. And so you mentioned, I'm going to have a look, it's a beautiful table, but it's all hand finished in order to get the design. So I think it's really interesting. It's not necessarily as simple as perhaps we think.
Indeed.
A lot more things going on.
Well, it's interesting. I've just come back from the Venice Biennale and... the Arsenali curated exhibition, I'd say 80% of that was handcrafted. And it was traditional skills, weaving, fabric, textiles, clay, timber. And it's like that whole rebirth of people wanting to understand material again is fantastic. So, yes, I'm really looking forward to what the NGV's got in next week.
I have another one.
And we've got one up the back.
Are there any difficulties in sourcing environmentally sustainable materials, such as timber? Is that a selling point?
It's a big selling point now because there's a whole lot in commercial, when we sell to the commercial market, they've got a Green Star rating that you have to meet. So we in our business, we use always water-based glues, water-based lacquers where possible. We have, it's a whole environmental sustainable thing. Everything that comes in from China, for example, is usually packed with polystyrene. We don't even use plastic bags where possible. We do with velvet because we wrap everything in blankets when we're transporting it. But velvet gets all the flint on it, so it's the only product that we really pack with packaging. Timbers, in the 60s, a lot of teak was used and still is sadly used with particular outdoor collections, and that is not an environmentally sustainable timber, so there are other things on the market. So other than that, we try and use local timbers where we can. We use an Australian blue gum, which is great on our veneer board. And even the veneer board is, you can get different grades of that, and we try and, where possible, where budget allows, we'll use the more sustainable, eco-friendly version.
Grazia, what are your favourite materials that you would like to use in your own designs, forgetting about the Featherstone ones where you're more dictated to by materials? What do you like to work with?
Probably because when we started the business, a friend of mine who I'd done a lot of work with over the years had a metal factory, and unfortunately his business was not going so well, and he's a really amazing metal worker, and we worked together for many, many years, even before I worked for Gordon. So, and one day my husband goes, "You better start designing in metal because we've just bought a metal factory." I've gone, "What?" So I think I had to learn about MIG welding and all this. So I think I probably, we've got a few core pieces that we make that have really pushed me to do that. So I probably understand, I never understood that medium before, so I understand it now, you know. I know which ones you can powder coat and which ones you can't. So I feel like my knowledge over the last couple of years in metalwork, and it's such a boy's domain usually, you know. So I think I've really enjoyed that part of the new business.
Yep.
And I don't think with the timber, what we do in timber is we manufacture a kind of on a, you know, everything's done on a computer basically. It's just hand designed and then we, you know, generate it on the CNC machine and everything's cut. Going back to the sustainability thing, we also make sure we use as much of the sheet as you can. So, you know, if a bedside table ends up being 450 wide, we can get the full cut out of the sheet of the veneer, or if we try and do it at 500 wide, you have to go into the next sheet and there's a lot of wastage. So we really try when we're designing to kind of maximise the yield out of every material, not just for cost but also for wastage. So that is a bit more mundane, I think, you know, that kind of side. And the upholstery is always beautiful, like seeing what the designers select for their piece is always fun, you know. But, yeah, probably the metalwork at this point.
I'm thinking we need to wrap it up. Time is getting away. But I'm so excited to leave the talk on the image I now have of Grazia on the MIG welder.
No.
Learning how to weld. That's fantastic. So thank you to Grazia so much for that. And I think we're going to be around. So if there's any more questions that we didn't get to, that you can come up and talk to myself or Grazia, and we can try out the chairs.
Yeah, absolutely. Try them out. I've carried them in.
That's right. Have a bit of a sit. And again, such a lovely venue to have this talk and to have Grazia's work and the other women that have spoken in this series in the context of Slava's exhibition, which, you know, she's a great icon for a very creative and determined person. And so there's a lovely synergy.
So that's it for this week's Creative Women in Conversation. Thank you to our wonderful speakers. If anyone would like to know more about the Dooldig Studio, please go to our website at www.dooldig.org.au. Thank you all very much.